Dave Pickering, I should give some introduction to, I suppose. Would you like me to? We'll flatter him. Just in case you haven't had a chance to have a look at the programme, and I trust this is accurate information here. We'll see. Judge by your facial expression whether it's accurate. Studied environmental science prior to training for the ministry, and since 1999 has developed and coordinated Eco-Congregation, a project to encourage and enable churches to integrate an environmental focus into their life and mission. So we're looking at this from this particular theme this evening, and you've heard enough of me, so hand over to David Pickering.
Thank you very much. Thank you, and it's very good to be here, and thank you for coming. I'd like to make the session as interactive as possible. We will have hopefully time for questions and answers at the end, but do feel if you want to query or question something, we can do that as we go along, because we're a relatively small group and that should be easy. I'd like to do four things or cover four things during the session successively. First, to explore, just for a few moments, some of your environmental concerns and might comment on one or two of those. So have a look at environmental concerns. Then to have a think on what on earth environmental concerns have to do with Christianity, and to explore some aspects of what we might say is a Christian ecological or Christian environmental thinking. So that's the second thing, the theology, which is perhaps our motivation, really. The third thing is to share some stories from churches that are doing good things. I've got some stories to share with you, but I hope we can make that a little interactive as well. And I hope there'll be, if you have some stories to share, please do so. And the fourth thing to do is that if you feel, well, yes, environmental issues are important at the end of this, if you feel a Christian drive or motivation, I can tell you a bit about Eco-Congregation, which has been designed to help. It's not aimed at individuals or whole denominations, but local churches. And as introduced, it's designed to help your local church green its life and mission, which is both an environmental activity and it's also a mission activity. Is that okay as an we'll start off then with the environment. What are your environmental concerns? What are the things that have motivated you to come to an environmental session?
Rubbish.
Waste. I mean, there's a couple of angles to waste, or there's a few angles. Firstly, there's no such thing as waste, in a sense. It's matter, and it's had to come from somewhere, and it's had to go somewhere. So when we talk about rubbish, there's a resource issue, because some resources have been reused in some sort of way. And secondly, it's got to go somewhere. We say throw it away, but actually it has to go somewhere. So we think of disposal. And so therefore we've got issues about resource use, and we've got issues about what do we do with it? Is it landfill? Is it incineration? Who's happy with having an incinerator near them? And landfill is, of course, a real issue, because there are only so many holes in the ground. So there's some issues around rubbish and waste. And the next bit is, of course, it's unsightly. It's a blight in our local environments. And it's been shown that where people feel, where there's a lot of rubbish, a lot of waste, a lot of litter, people both feel a greater fear of crime, and it's those sort of areas are associated with more crime, and it actually brings down the spirit of the area too. So perhaps one of an important thing to do in sort of regeneration terms is actually to combat litter, because it does make that has an important role to play in the well-being of local communities. So an issue with a lot of dimensions to it. Thank you. And yes?
Uncontrolled use of energy.
Uncontrolled use. And say why. Right, yes.
We're obviously running out of fuel, and people should put a jumper on instead of taking their shirt off, as it were.
Yes.
And there seems to be no concept in society's mind about where all this energy is coming from. And we've only just looked at America and what they're taking out and their lack of concern.
Right. I think there's a number of issues around energy. I mean, just to pick up a little bit on the American one, some people are concerned that some of the motivations for the Iraqi war have to do with securing energy supplies. But I'll take you back to the 70s, and I think the big worry in the 70s was there's not enough. We're going to run out. Do you remember the time when we had the fuel cuts and there was a report published about, you know, we will run out of in gas in so many years, in oil in so many years, in coal in so many years. And that's so in that we're talking about finite resources. But environmental terms, I think the concerns have switched. And it's not so much the concern we're going to run out and squander, in a sense, millennia and millennia of inheritance in a very short time. But the concern is with the fossil fuels, gas, oil and coal principally, that in burning them, we're releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which is a major contributor to global warming, which is itself causing climate change. And I say that quite strongly. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is made up of leading scientists from around the world, you know, have done very clear work to show that this is a real phenomenon. And the reasons to be concerned about it are various. I mean, it might be very nice to have a warm spot, you know, spot in the middle of August. But if we cast our mind back last year, there were devastating floods and costly floods across Central Europe. This year, of course, the heating of the climate has been associated with forest fires and a wealth of premature deaths in other parts of Europe. But actually the biggest cost with climate change is born in the developing nations, which, because they have the least ability to adapt to it, they don't perhaps have the insurance, they don't have Tesco's round the corner when their crops fail for whatever reason. Christian Aid actually did a report 3 years ago called Unnatural Disasters, in which they highlighted that the Christian Aid do much work with their money in many ways. There's education, there's development, one of which is disaster relief. But they estimated that 9 of the previous disasters they'd responded to were actually linked to climate change. Now, we can't say the floods of last year or the hot summer of this year and the forest fires or whatever. We can't actually say that that one incident is caused by climate change. But what we can say is the global warming, which is predicted, which is leading to climate change, the sort of changing weather patterns and disasters we're seeing are entirely consistent. And in a sense, we're living today with what was done 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and more. And our energy use today is going to have a really serious impact on tomorrow's generation. So to take your energy, it used to be the big thing was about running out, and I think now we're just burning too much, and it's threatening to have catastrophic impacts across the world. I'll just say one last thing. We talked about environment, but both these issues, the waste and the global warming climate change, have a justice element too, because they impact unjustly on the poor, who have the least capacity to respond to it, and unjustly too, because they, generally speaking, have made the least contribution to the problem. So in all this, in talking about environmental issues, we cannot separate out environment and justice. We could go for many more issues, but I'll stop there. And they're two good issues, because in a sense, one's local in a way, and one's global in a way. So if we can hang it there, but perhaps you've got many other issues and we can explore those a little later. Are you happy to move on to why as Christians we might be concerned? Got a series of principles to share with you. We all know from the Psalms, the earth belongs to the Lord. What does this have to say in our faith? Well, firstly, to explore aspects of the first stories of creation. There are two stories right at the beginning of the Bible. There's the 6 days of creative activity and the 7 days of rest. And then there's the second story, sometimes known as the garden story, with the Garden of Eden. Now, some Christians, particularly in America, understand these in a very literal way. But I'd like to suggest right at the beginning that we need to reinterpret these stories with not just a modern-day understanding, but actually perhaps an understanding which is nearer to that with which they were first told. And that is that the stories lay out aspects of the relationship between God, between humanity and the rest of creation. We'll explore a little bit of that as we go through these principles. So their story is about that relationship. Now, in the first story, in a sense, it lays out that God is the creator, a creating God. And from that story, we get one of those one of the central doctrines of the Christian church, which is called the doctrine of creation, which goes something like this. The earth and all it contains comes from the free creating actions, and I use actions because we believe God's creative activity is ongoing. It wasn't a one-off event many years ago. Come from the free creative actions of a loving God. That's part of what holds us together as Christians. And it informs us something about who God is and our relationship to God. Say a little bit more about the earth belongs to the Lord as well. Have any of you ever been to a beautiful place? Top of a mountain, a valley with a river flowing through it, and had a sense of the presence of God? Any of you ever? There's an expression that creation is God's first evangelist. In other words, people first got to sense the presence of God when out in what we understand is behind which is God's creative activity. And to suggest that if we scar creation, it actually puts a barrier between people and their sense of God. We should no more want to deface Canterbury Cathedral or any other sacred site as we should want to deface the creation which is laid out for us. The earth belongs to the Lord. It tells us about the way we are to understand creation. Got one more story to do with the earth belongs to the Lord. We like going on holidays to Scottish islands. That's our thing. And when we go, we often rent a cottage because we've got young children. And a couple of years ago, we went to one cottage and my wife had done all the negotiations and sent the check off. And we got a lovely letter back saying, it's yours. You'll find the key inside it. Please enjoy it. It's got a fabulous view. But could you leave it as you found it for the next holidaymakers who are coming in? What she was saying was, and of course you do, don't you? She was saying, the cottage belongs to me. You are free to enjoy it, and I hope you will for that time. And at the end of your stay, will you leave it for the next folk? The earth belongs to the Lord. Perhaps we can understand in that, but we have the God-given privilege to enjoy all of creation, but we have bound up within it a responsibility to care for it too, and perhaps leave it for the next generation, as we found it, in the same way as we would hoover around a rented cottage so that the next people don't live in our dirt. Suggest to you that God's care extends to all living creatures. We'll go back to that first creation story from Genesis. And it's a story which you could imagine, I'd like to invite you to imagine, but it was actually told in worship. Am I obstructing your view? No. It was told in worship. And this story actually has some responses to it. And you'll know some of the responses. Let me try you out. Evening came and... And the next one is, and God saw. And you could imagine that story being told actually in worship, in the presence of a group like us, perhaps by some an older worship leader, and in the presence of younger children, and they in turn will grow up and retell that story. And it's said that that story was told for many generations in the oral tradition before it was committed to paper. And it lays out something of our understanding of God. But and God saw it was good tells us something too. It tells us that God sees worth in all of creation. Sometimes we might be tempted to say, well, we mustn't cut down the Brazilian rainforest because there might be some cancer-curing drug. Have you heard that sort of argument? And that's a very, very... If that motivates people to not cut down the rainforest, that's great. But in a sense, that argument is... I think the big word is anthropocentric. But the simple is... what's in it for us? We shouldn't cut down the rainforests because there might be something in it for us. But and God saw it was good, which is the refrain used in the creation stories, reminds us that actually God sees value in creation. We understand it's given to us, but because the giver sees value in it, we should respect it and perhaps care for it too. And the teaching in the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, reinforces that. There are in the minutiae, if you look, there are laws about land and what's now called set aside and used to be crop rotation, but actually derives from some of the Deuteronomic laws, which says for 1 year in seven, your land shall lie fallow. It's a law which actually links justice and environment, because not only does it allow the land to have a rest, as it were, and wild plants and animals to grow too, but it has linked with it that gleaning so that the poor can find something too. So environment and development were linked in that way too. But elsewhere in the Torah, you'll find references to how many eggs you could or could not take out of a bird's nest. And the inkling is that actually you leave some eggs for the continuation of the species. And you'll find laws about what trees you can or cannot cut down in warfare. And somewhere within that, there's a respect for creation, the land, along with the respect we understand for God's people, particularly the poor, the widows, the orphans. So, God's care and concern extends to all living, all of creation. And shouldn't ours too? God's care also extends to all generations. This is another. You complete the sentence. I believe in God who was. And we believe in our understanding of God who was in the past and is now and is to come. It tells us this, but we can look back and sense, we can look back retrospectively and see how God has loved and cared for, well, the people in biblical times, people in past generations, or even in looking back in our lives. And that gives us an assurance that God is with us now and gives us the hope that God will be with us in the future. But it also reminds us that actually God cares for those people to come in the future too. Our God is an intergenerational God, and our concerns shouldn't stop with our generation or our children's generation or our grandchildren's generation. And yet our care of the environment suggests that's where our concerns do stop. I think I've already spoken to this slide, which is care for the environment and justice for all people are inextricably linked. You won't find environment as a word in the Bible, but there is much said about justice for people. And you can't separate them. And sometimes, in caring for people and people's needs, we need to consider their environment, the environment too. There is much said about justice, but to think you can act and promote justice without also caring for the environment is a misunderstanding. They go hand in hand. God calls us from sin to repentance and reunion with God's purpose. I guess that's a call which is not a one-off call, but it's a call we understand week by week in our Christian worship. And it's a call we find in the Bible as well. It stems from the fall that we are called to God's way to live our lives according to God's purpose. And God's make commitments back to us too. It's interesting that the very first promise or covenant made in the Bible was in fact an environmental covenant. The Noahic covenant, the covenant to Noah, where God promised that he would not send a flood again, was made to Noah. And the next few words in the Bible are, and to all living creatures. God's concern, God's covenant, extends to all living creatures. Now, I guess we understand that the creatures can't save themselves, but we can read into that or understand in that a calling for us to offer a renewed creation back to God. Now we'll go for some of the big words. Is anyone in Jonathan Porritt's talk earlier today? Because he did bring up the Dominion one. like to have a look at some of these words which come out of Genesis, particularly the commandment to subdue and exercise dominion. And I suggest three things about this. Firstly, there was an influential paper written by someone called Lynn White back in 67, published in the American Journal Science, in which he laid a lot of the blame for the world's environmental crisis at what he called the Judaic Christian heritage. And to paraphrase, in a sense, he said, "You've preached dominion, and that's what's happened." To answer that, I'd suggest that, firstly, I think the church should be contrite, because environmental or creation care has not featured greatly on our agenda. And there's not been many prominent figures in environmental Christianity between St. Francis and today. Not many. Secondly, though, it was perhaps a little unfair because there are many parts of the world which have suffered environmental blight, not necessarily touched by the Judaic Christian heritage. But thirdly, and most importantly, because to equate subdue and dominion with domination is a misunderstanding of the texts in Genesis. We'll start with both of them are strong words, subdue and dominion, and used elsewhere in other biblical contexts in the Old Testament in quite strong ways. But let's start with the word subdue. I think I'd like you to cast your mind back, not 2,000 years, but 2,000 years before Christ, in the sort of times when these stories were told from and passed down the generations. And in those days, of course, as we explored before, there wasn't Tesco's round the corner, there wasn't insurance, but people were very vulnerable to storms, floods, natural disasters, locusts, just whatever. And subdue, or the motivation behind subdue, was to set down sufficient on the environment, to have a homestead, as it were, that you could supply your needs and get you through the year. But subdue was not understood as a complete domination, for in fact that doesn't give you your supplies for the year, it can spoil them. And to say further, we might see a Christian understanding of subdue in the action of Christ on the storm-tossed boat, when he subdued creation, subdued the waves, with the motivation being for the well-being of the disciples. So it's an understanding of subdue. And what about dominion? Well, go back to Old Testament times too. And through the Old Testament, there was a long period where kings were called to rule. And that's, we understand, it wasn't quite God's wish at the time, but that's what the people wanted. So there was some guidance given to how kings could rule. What I'd suggest to you essentially is dominion is an understanding that you rule according to the law of God by one made in the image of God. So the kings of the Old Testament times, in exercising dominion, were not called to rule for their own self-aggrandizement, but called to rule, if according to the law of God, for the benefit of, well, the land. We've explored that. We've explored aspects of creation, and for the benefit of the orphans, the Levites, the widows, and so on. So dominion isn't to do what you like in biblical times. It's actually to reclaim the understanding is very much about ruling as one made in the image of God according to God's purpose. The second story of creation is a lovely story, and it has a command in it too. And depending on the translation, it's Genesis 2:15. It says something to till and tend or care. And in that, we get a whole new understanding of a relationship between humanity and creation. The command is given to the Adam, the one made from the earth, into whom the breath of God has been given. And it's one made from that earth who is called to till and tend. It's not an exploitive relationship. It's a living, loving relationship with that from where the Adam came, and this applies to each of us, to that to where the Adam will return. And in between, it's not about exploitation, till and care. And out of that, we can understand, we can start to build some principles which we might call stewardship. We might see we're almost, one of the Psalms suggests we're co-creators, but we can see that we, in this relationship between God the Creator, creation and ourselves. We can understand we have a God-given, we understand it, it's a God-given gift to live and enjoy the gift of creation, but it comes with responsibility, and we might call it stewardship, or we might call it a whole number of other words too. And we're reminded too that our God is also what we'd say is a down-to-earth God, not just a transcendent God way above, but also a God who's amongst us and came down to earth in the flesh and blood in the stable. Our God, as it were, is made up of the same DNA. He came from the soil and will return to the soil in that molecular sense too. And our God is wrapped up in and is in a part of creation. I go a little bit further about Christ as well. In John 3:16, oh, well, you can complete the sentence. God so loved. And that's a text which is much used, and people value it in terms of personal salvation. But what's interesting, actually, is that the phrase is God so loved the world. And actually, the Greek from which it comes says the cosmos, so it's even bigger than that. It's the whole shebang. And we can sense in Christ God's salvific purpose for the whole of creation to which we are called to participate in. I think that's all about Christian principles. Should we take a breather there for a moment? Any questions on that before we get down to the more earthy and what we can do? Yeah. Oh, yes. UK postcode analysis. It was on the slide. Friends of the Earth did a study about 4 or 5 years ago, and you can check, it is on their website still, where they checked out, they correlated incidents of polluted or not poor environments, which they defined as near to busy roads, downwind from polluting factories, and so on, the poorest environments. And they found a very close correlation with that and the postcodes with the lowest household income. And that was a little bit about saying earlier that the link between poverty and environment is both a developing nations thing and it's within nations too. I don't know if you know, but if you look at any of our major cities, it's an interesting exercise. You pick a city, and I worry. Would someone like to name a city, and then I'll tell you what we're going to do with it? Any city?
Sheffield,
right. Where's the posh housing and where's the poor housing? And I bet you, I don't know Sheffield so well, is it the south and west have got the good housing and the north and east have got the poor housing? On average, yeah. And you can look at most cities and say that. The reason is, in Britain, our prevailing wind comes from the south and the west. And Sheffield's a very good place to pick, actually, because it particularly impacts on what we might say our industrial nations. As all the grolly went up in the air, it was blown, on most days, that way. So if you look at most of our, particularly industrial cities, you'll see the better places to live, in inverted commas, are on the south and west side. And it's for poorer people who have to put up with some of the the environmental contaminants. And it's just a little exercise, but I invite you to think of any city in Britain, perhaps Liverpool's not, perhaps coastal cities we have to remove because that doesn't have quite a south and a west. Any other questions on the Christian motivations? Yeah.
You mentioned looking again at what subdue and dominion mean in Genesis. The thing I find difficult being someone who likes scrambling about some of those words actually meant when they first used is that in the intervening period between then and now, there has been a lot of interpretation and use of words which has led us to the current situation.
Yes. I mean, I hope that in saying at the beginning that I think we need to be contrite is appropriate too.
And
I apologize. It was really, has, in essence, the understanding of dominion, which has become about the master of creation and perhaps become wrapped up in the Protestant work ethic and has led to some exploitation. It's how do we address that? Is that the question? Yeah. And I suggest that we need to put alongside or balance the contriteness as well as reclaiming the scripture for what we now understand it to be and perhaps a more appropriate understanding. And we hold together those things and we must be prophetic where we see that scriptural, that being misunderstood. I'll give you for example. I once heard a lady say, God's promised us a new heaven and a new earth, so we don't need to worry about caring for this one. And I take an extreme, but I guess that needs to be challenged. That's frightening, yes. Any other questions, or shall we move on? Yeah. Right. I did have another one as well, which actually has got the E word on it, but I decided I wouldn't use it. I guess I'd say that Christianity offers a couple of things which perhaps set us apart and a real message of hope for the world, because Friends of the Earth is a wonderful organisation. They do great things, and so do the Green Party and all these other organisations. But sometimes their motivation is out of fear of what is, rather than hope for what might be. And I think in terms of us looking to the future, we should undertake our discipleship, not with some sort of blind, blinkered hope, but a hope which actually is about engaging with the issues and thinking we're not going to go away from here and do nothing and carry on business as usual in our lifestyles. But actually, this is a challenge to the way we live, our churches live, the world works. And that say something about that hope. Secondly, that E word, eschatology, and a new heaven and a new earth. The phrase or the promise of a new heaven and new earth, in 2 Peter, I think it says that that the earth will be, what one of the translations is, the earth will be burned. Another translation of it is the earth will be found. And behind that is the understanding that actually a new heaven and a new earth will come about when God's mission, God's kingdom, as it were, is brought to fruition. And our role in that is not as passive people, but it is part of our discipleship. And we, in caring for God's creation, we do it not for ourselves, but we do it somehow to offer a renewed creation back to God, the Creator. Is that sufficient? If not, we'll debate afterwards so I can move on to the next bit. Will that be okay? I don't want to avoid the E word, though. So what can we do? Well, I told you Eco Congregation is a church-based environmental project, and its aim is to encourage and inspire churches to action. We're going to have a round robin in a minute, but I'm going to flash through a few slides which will show you what some churches have done, and then we'll come back to think about what your church could do. Hold a special creation service. This church actually got a giant earth, and they got the brownies and their young people to tell the story of creation and make their own pledges to care for God's creation. And one of the important things behind this is perhaps some of the things they do might be quite small, but it's actually significant. It's a changing hearts and minds, so we think in a new way. So, and I'd suggest that any care of creation within a Christian sense is best first rooted in worship. So it's seen not as one of those added extras on the bottom of a long agenda, but it's seen as an intrinsic part of our Christian discipleship and church mission. St. Luke's Church in Formby have a green corner in every magazine, and it goes out to their church members, but it goes wider than that to the parish, and it gives them examples about what they can do in their life. And underneath it, they sometimes have this catchword, caring for the environment, caring for God's creation, helping people to make that link so that they understand it is part of our Christian discipleship. an energy project, changing light bulbs where possible to low energy ones, addresses the climate change point, the energy change point in some way. It's also, it makes very good sense for churches because you cut your light energy bill by 80%. And where churches, where the lights are sometimes a bit sort of remote, you only have to change them 1/10 the number of times, which the property steward is generally pleased about. But also, churches can be places where we can share this message more widely. But the picture in the on the bottom left-hand corner of the slide shows a corrugated cardboard model house made by children. But what the children did is, they illustrated energy-saving measures which could be adopted by households. And they did it to encourage people in their village to think about energy-saving in their personal lives. But it came from a church. Make and install nest boxes. Now, our church's youth group did this. I have to say, I think they would say it's one of the best fun things we did. We got a couple of park rangers along. They told them about bird nesting, and then we got to work with a hammer and nails. I think we sailed fairly close to the wind with good practice in terms of a hammer and nails, but that's why they loved it. And then we put up the nest boxes. They went up on Good Friday. I'm not sure if we should be putting nest boxes up on Good Friday. We put our nest boxes up on Good Friday. And within 4 weeks, we, and that's our young people, had a family of blue tits. And it was great. It was great. Wasn't it, children? Sometimes as churches, we like to visit places. We have field outings, guilds go places. This church went to visit a school with a wind generator to it. They wanted to see the wind generator and to think about, I mean, it's a fun place to go. And caring for the environment can be fun. They found out some information. And they're now thinking, actually, about purchasing green electricity for their church. This church installed an environmental notice board. And they put it in a bit of their parish hall, not where just their few church, where their more limited congregation would see it, but where the whole community went in and out for a whole range of meetings, activities, even to elect folk. But the whole village, in a sense, could see that this church was working to care for the environment. It was part of their mission. I've already talked about the link between environment and development, and choosing fairly traded products is a good way forward too. A number of churches do that or hold fairly traded stalls. This church actually put together a stall where they purchased one of each item which was fairly traded from their local supermarket and put it out on display and said, you can buy these items in your local supermarket. If you choose to buy them there, the supermarket's more likely to stock them, so therefore other people more likely to buy them too. One church, Bethesda Methodist Church, which is actually in Cheltenham, have gone a stage further and they renamed their tradecraft stall and they call it Trade Green. And they sell low energy light bulbs and nest boxes and a whole range of items as well. Recycling, tackling the waste element too. For most churches, actually leaving, it's more convenient to use to leave the paper, glass, and what are the other big things? Tins, to the supermarket car parks or whatever, because that's adequately done there. But one of our churches, they decided they'd try and collect smaller, more valuable items, and they organised a monthly recycling scheme where each month they would highlight something. So obviously January was Christmas cards, but then going on February stamps, another one tin foil, another one mobile phones, another one printer ink cartridges, and they got a list right through the year. And every month they put a press release in their local paper and they invited, and their church was open once a week for a coffee morning, and just people come and drop by and drop these items off, and then they distributed them through a variety of locations. And there wasn't the sort of the risk or the big storage issues which sometimes exist with churches. One church I worked with, again, it's a church in Evesham. Last year, I think it was collected something like 70,000 plus aluminium cans, but actually raised over £1,100 for church funds. And one church, Selly Oak Methodist Church, have just collected their 1,000th pair of spectacles, which go through a high street optician, receive a prescription, which is done via the prison service, and then taken overseas. And those sort of activities, perhaps small beer in terms of recycling, but there's a justice element too. And it's about people acting. This church arranged a litter pick, but they didn't just do it themselves. They invite their community. They do it once a year, and they invite their community along too. What could your church do? In this church, the brownies were given a patch in which to weed and grow nasturtiums. And another church I know, the brownies, they wanted to do a wildlife garden. It was a URC, and it had a very small area. And I think they got a piece about 5 foot by 3 foot. And they dug it over with their hand forks, and they sowed wildlife seeds and some plug plants, and they care for it with scissors. And I guess in terms of biodiversity and rainforests, it's not going to do great things. But in terms of hearts and minds, it's a really powerful thing, and it's their patch, and they're caring for it. Divide churchyards into two sorts. The sort I've just mentioned, where there's nothing great of any ecological value, and it, almost you can think about doing a ground force. What could your church do? But some churches actually have churchyards with a high ecological value. This is one of them. They had it researched, and they now manage it to care for in a positive conservation way, but have also made it a fun educational resource, and they have built a little environmental classroom at the back of their church, which is used by their two primary schools. The gravestones are an interesting one. Some of them were toppling over. They have them all mapped as a student project for Leeds University. And then they've used them in a variety of ways, some of them to make paths, and they've even got a mathematics worksheet linked into the national curriculum for children to do sums based on the dates on the gravestones. I mean, it's a great thing to do, isn't it? No grounds to look after. This church, the minister wanted to get his own hands dirty. It's actually Wakefield Baptist Church. And they committed themselves for a Saturday every 2 months, but perhaps they missed out the December one, I'm not sure. But essentially it was five times in the year, and they went and did conservation work. And the minister said it was really good actually getting your hands dirty and feel you're doing something practical. Wakefield Baptist Church is quite an evangelical church, and they were particularly motivated because they discovered that the only other group volunteering at this particular location was the Wakefield Pagan Society. And when they found that, they couldn't stop. They just had to keep going. I'll have a pause there. I'd like to ask you, what have you done, or what could your church do? What have you done? Or what could your church do? Yeah. Right. Two things to say about that. I mean, green electricity is a really good thing to do. Anyone, is it helpful to say what green electricity is? Essentially, what it is, but if you buy it from that supplier must have bought in at least that amount of green electricity from a green source, such as hydro, wind, or some of the other renewable sources. If you want to have a guide to what's a good green source, because there is a sort of a bit of a, you know, some are better than others. Friends of the Earth have a really good league table, but to say that Christian Ecology Link, who Eco Congregation worked together with, and we're actually sharing a stall in the Pulse area, Christian Ecology Link are now promoting a project called Operation Noah, which is very much behind encouraging churches to sign up and buy green electricity. So thank you. What? Wind up now. We'll have to. We've got another 10 minutes, I think. I've asked you what your church is doing, what it could do next. Eco Congregation is designed to help you ask that question yourselves, what you're already doing, what you might like to do next, and then take some positive action. It aims to do this, to encourage churches and their members to celebrate the gift of creation and care for it in appropriate practical and spiritual ways. The starting point is not out of doom and gloom, although that well might motivate us, but as a positive response to God the Creator. And if you want to go home and back to your church and think, well, I want to do something practical, let me tell you how Eco Congregation, it's like a toolkit rather than a program. It's got resources that can help you. It's got three things. Firstly, it's got sets of resources to it. If you would like, at the end of this session, to take one of these, that's in the big pile, not the little leaflets. This has got a little leaflet about Eco Congregation. It's got a tear-off slip for more information, but you don't need to send that off. Include it in this pack is a covering letter and a guide to help you identify what you're doing and what you want to prioritise next. You might say it's an eco audit. So that, and there's a newsletter in there as well. So if you'd like to take one of those at the end, you'll be very welcome. We also we ran a pilot study, and our pilot study told us that we'd like some resources to help us, but don't give us resources by environmental issues. Give us resources that will fit into church life. So we've got one called Celebrating Creation, which is for worship leaders. We've got Acorns to Oaks, which has got activities for young people, so you give it to children. We've got one called Greening the Cornerstone, which is for property committees. So that caring for God's creation isn't that one-off activity, but it actually infuses through the whole of the church life. And all the modules that we have to offer are in the front. You're welcome to come and inspect them. If you could leave them, that would be great. But if your church does an audit and a church meeting agrees, yes, we want to take this forward, you can order any of those free of charge. The second thing we've got in terms of to offer is support. There's a website. Site is given on the bottom of this. There's a newsletter, there's telephone support. And if you want to do something, for example, on recycling, we can put you in touch with your local recycling officer. So Eco Congregation can't come and do things for your church, but hopefully we can put you in touch with somebody who can. And the third thing that we offer is an award. Why do we want an award? The award is for this reason. Firstly, it's to act as a target. You know, if your church needs a new organ or a new roof, you put up one of those thermometers and you fill in the bits, don't you? And when you get to the top, you celebrate. Well, I guess if you're serious about this, you might set yourself some targets and work towards them, and that's a target. And when you get there, why not celebrate? So it acts as a target. Also acts as an affirmation. We're not very good at churches at saying, well, let me say, well done, you good and faithful servant, until the person enters the church horizontally. But why shouldn't we not affirm good work? And the Eco Congregation Award is designed to affirm good, committed work by churches. It's judged independently. We use independent assessors. And it's given for churches which have done an audit and which have done initiatives in each of three areas: spiritual, perhaps in worship, but making the link between environmental issues and the Christian faith. Practical, well, it might be a churchyard project, an energy project, a recycling project. And community orientated, might be working with a local school or a litter pick or a whole combination of things. And if your church has done those, we hope you'll apply for the award. We've had awards presented by Jonathan Porritt, David Bellamy, Bishop of Liverpool, Bishop of Hereford. They've been really celebratory activities for local churches. My final slide. This has come from a church which gained the award. It's Northallerton, Zion URC in Northallerton in North Yorkshire. And the minister said this: along with our social outreach, our environmental mission has been good for the church, has helped bring us together as a family and grow as a family. It has been heartening, inspiring and enjoyable. Environment is a topic which all our neighbours are concerned about. but we have a particular mandate as Christians. By caring for God's creation in our church life, we are responding, making a positive response to our Creator God. But we're also trying to, I guess, spread the news about what Christianity is about and some of the important things to those people who might be surprised that the church has a take on environmental issues, but very heartened. Thank you for that. Be pleased to have any questions if we've got any time left. Yeah, we've got some time. And do take one of those packs if you'd like it at the end. Yeah.
Where they've been disappointed at how they've seen their own institutions dealing with things. So whether there's actually a moral obligation on us to rebuild bridges with them to local level.
I quite go along with that. And I'd add this to it as well. I grew up in a Christian family, was brought to church, and I grew up with an interest in environmental issues. So I studied environmental science at college. But it was actually somewhere along the way that those twin tracks, as it were brought together. And it was a penny-dropping and life-changing experience, in a sense. And I think in our congregations, there are many people who are concerned about environmental issues, who are members of Friends of the Earth, National Trust, RSPB, just whatever, but haven't linked that to their Christian conviction and faith. And that's, you know, we have that role both to make that links within our church and, as you say, to bridge building without.
Sorry, can I just add, I know
oh, yes.
You in time, but can I just do this for the tape as well? If I can get to you, I will otherwise.
I'm sorry, we should have remembered the tape.
I sort of leapt up. There we go.
Okay. Do you think it's important to reduce use of pesticides and herbicides or not use them at all?
Yeah. Let me tell you about Eco Congregation, first of all. Our partner is Churches Together. I'll answer it in two ways, a personal way and then for the project. Our partner is Churches Together in Britain and Ireland. And as such, we keep ourselves aligned with the environmental thinking of all the mainstream churches. But we work very closely with organisations like Christian Ecology Link, who are represented here, who have what we might say that work at the sharper end and the campaigning end, and would work and take a stance on issues about, well, I don't think they've done so much on pesticides, but certainly on GM. Eco Congregation tends to stick with those things which come within the remit or orbit of the mainstream churches. And the reason for that is that we actually want to attract not the 5% of more radical churches, but the 95% of churches of all good willing, as it were, but who haven't considered environmental issues. So you won't find anything in this project about vegetarianism, about nuclear fuel, about GM, about animals, because those are issues which tend to put us apart and for this project might be counterproductive. To answer your question, though, we have an organic garden. If
I chair a fair trade group in my town, and a number of the people there find great difficulty in persuading Christians within their churches to actually take the action that we've been talking about. Even in my church, we had to take a proposition to PCC to get the lady to use fair trade coffee. Do you have any comments on this? Because it seems disaster.
And I bet you the Nestle slips in still, doesn't it? Because I think I'd say this, and this applies to, in a sense, the whole talk apart from your issue. Eco Congregation, along with Christian Ecology Link and all the other partners, and lots of people doing little things, is part of a process. And I look back 20 years ago, and environment just wasn't on the agenda. Now, Greenbelt, for example, have formed, and Jerry's here and is a part of it, and ethics, environmental and... Ethical environmental unit, because it is important. The Methodist Church have an environmental policy. The Baptist Union have an environmental policy. The bishops of the Church of England have spoken out strongly and circulated a letter on environmental issues. And they, thankfully, they commend Eco Congregation. we're not going to change things overnight. There'll always be glitches along the way. The sort of the equivalent of a Nestle will appear in our environmental work. And let's be honest, sometimes it's about a balance, about environmental, you know, there isn't a this is right necessarily and this is wrong. You've got to work out what seems to be treading more gently on the earth. I think I'm heartened because it's a positive process and we're going the right direction and environment is rising up the church's agenda. How good to have Jonathan Porritt at an event like this. But the challenge is still there because there's so much more to do and the environmental issues which face us are really quite immense and potentially devastating for future generations. So process, I think.
We do have time for one more, but we'll have to be brief on both sides, unfortunately.
When it comes to what we need to confess because of environmental destruction and the Holocaust we face, as part of confession, when it comes to wanting to make reparation and penitence, in some ways, surely we need to match what we do in terms of penitence and reparation to the size of the sin that has been committed. And that would be one question I'd ask about the award and whether it's appropriate to be awarding tiny steps, as good as those are. Is it right to be awarding tiny steps when we're facing Holocaust?
Right. I think I go back to process, and that just has to be. And they might be tiny steps, but they might be big steps in our hearts. And let me suggest and try and be positive. But actually, by doing these, well, let's go to the Jubilee 2000 movement, which came largely out of the UK churches or Britain and Ireland churches. It was about lots of people doing little things, and it generated. They didn't so much do so much, but in making demands, they created the political demand and the political space for our politicians to take much bolder leaps. Now, I think some of the last two environment ministers, and I can be apolitical in that Michael Meacher and John Gummer, so from both of the main parties, were actually very committed people. And I have a feeling that they wanted to take the issues much further, but they lacked the political space. Cast your mind back to the petrol crisis that we had nearly 3 years ago. Everyone was crying out, we must have this petrol. But the very small voices were saying, well, actually, isn't life a little better now? Now our roads aren't clogged up. We can cycle down them. We can walk. I mean, there were inconveniences, but there was another side too. So small actions can actually lead to political demands for change, which can actually address those big issues. Thank you. And that's our role as churches, to be part of this transformation and process.